This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, August 28th, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. Willpower is a powerful resource, and recent research indicates it's relatively finite, but something we can cultivate over time with some effort. New York Times columnist John Tierney at Cato University discussed the value of willpower in an age of endless decision-making.
As a libertarian, as a fellow libertarian, one of my favorite bits of social science involves the link between intelligence and political ideology. Various studies showed that conservatives tend to be rigid and closed-minded. And these findings are definitely true because they were done by scientists in academia who are famous, who are famously unbiased and open to a wide spectrum of ideas politically. I mean, I know some of you are in school now and are aware that there are some faculty on campus who are Democrats, but there are also many faculty members who vote with the Green Party, too. So, now when these researchers looked at IQ, they reported with barely disguised glee that socially conservative Republicans have lower IQs than liberal Democrats. But then, they were stunned to discover that the average IQ of Republicans is higher than the average IQ of Democrats. And how could this be? Well, because the libertarians in the Republican Party were so much smarter than the Democrats and everyone else. So, so I congratulate you all on your genius. And tonight I want to talk about another wonderful libertarian trait, which is self-control. The connection between freedom and self-control was obvious to the great libertarians who founded our country. On July 4th, 1776, as his Revolutionary Declaration of Human Freedom was being adopted in Philadelphia, Thomas Jefferson took some time out for some less exalted prose. In his notebook, he meticulously wrote down everything he bought that day at a shop in Philadelphia and the exact price of it, you know, like £3.15 for a thermometer. Now, not even the Declaration of Independence could distract him from this lifelong passion to write down everything he bought. Now, his obsessive record keeping was a bit extreme, and there are people who have diagnosed him with some disorders, but his passion for self-control, for setting goals and for monitoring himself, was common among his colleagues in Philadelphia. You know, Ben Franklin kept this notebook where each week he had these charts in it, and each week he would chart his progress toward 13 different virtues like temperance and frugality, industry, cleanliness. George Washington, as a young man, he wrote down 110 rules of civility that he wanted to follow, and a couple of them might be relevant tonight. One of them was, drink not, nor talk with your mouth full. And one that actually I consider more important, sleep not when others speak. Now, the Founding Fathers believed in the unalienable right to liberty, but they knew it depended on personal responsibility. You know, during the Enlightenment and then later during the Victorian era, people worried very much about the decline of religion and the decline of traditional social control of behavior by village churches, by lords of the manor. And so people who believed in human freedom wanted something to replace that. And they realized that to be free from a tyrant's rule, men had to be able to rule themselves. You know, that truth seemed self-evident to them. Now today it's even more evident, although it has taken social scientists, those liberals in academia, a long time to catch up with the Founding Fathers. During the 20th century, as researchers studied the irrational and the unconscious forces in the brain, their faith in self-control waned. It was replaced by a faith in state control. The original progressives in the early 20th century envisioned an America that was guided by experts who would mold a new kind of society. They believed the future belonged to societies that stressed collective responsibility, not individual responsibility. And social scientists were very eager to go along with this. They were basically the experts in shaping human behavior. They were sort of the new priests of this order. And they provided the rationale for prohibition. And when that progressive reform failed, they went on looking for all kinds of new ways to regulate the rest of society. The growing nanny state dictated which vices were legal, which temptations could be advertised, which medicines could be sold, which foods were permissible, which sugary beverages were allowed. Nothing over 16 ounces in New York. We don't allow that up there. Now, you could see this shift in politics. You could see it in social science research. And you could also see it in popular culture, most notably, to me at least, on the self-help racks at airport bookstores. And believe me, I know what is in those self-help racks. I have read more bad self-help books than Oprah and Dr. Phil combined. Those books are what got me into this subject. It started one evening. I was at dinner with a friend of mine, Christopher Buckley, the comic novelist, and we were talking about the great subject that always comes up when serious writers get together, which is money. And we concluded that we needed more of it. And we were so jealous of the mega sales of the self-help books that we decided to write one of our own. And it was a novel titled God is My Broker. The subtitle is A Monk Tycoon Reveals the 7.5 Laws of Spiritual and Financial Growth. It tells a story of Brother Ty, an alcoholic who fails as a trader on Wall Street, and then manages to sober up by going to a monastery in upstate New York that makes wine so bad that even he can't drink it. And the monastery is going broke because of the awful wine. But Brother Ty rescues it thanks to stock tips that he thinks are coming from God. And as this new money rolls into the monastery, the monks kind of relax their vow of poverty. They spend a fortune renovating the monastery with the help of a very hip interior designer from downtown Manhattan who comes up. And when he looks over the place, and when they ask him, what kind of look do you have in mind for the monastery? He says, well, we want it to say poverty, but we don't want it to say cheap. And so... Along the way, our monk discovers the 7.5 laws of financial and spiritual growth, such as, money is God's way of saying thanks. And God loves the poor, but that doesn't mean you have to fly coach. And there's my favorite law, as long as God knows the truth, it doesn't matter what you tell your customers. Now, to write this parody, I went back through the history of self-help books, you know, starting with Ben Franklin. And I noticed this curious trend. You know, from Ben Franklin through the Victorian era, the books stressed, you know, hard work and perseverance. They had maxims like genius is patience. But then in the 20th century, a whole new kind of self-help book started. And they started offering quick fixes and self-esteem and this feel-good philosophy with a rhyming slogan. Believe it, achieve it. Deepak Chopra offered something called the law of least effort. And I will quote it to you verbatim. Ultimately, you come to the state where you do nothing and accomplish everything. And I guess it worked for him. But to me, it seemed there'd been this strange backward evolution. The old Victorian books seemed smarter than their descendants. And I didn't know what to make of this until I started writing a science column for the New York Times, and I met the social psychologist Roy Baumeister, with whom I ended up writing the book Willpower. Roy had been an early leader into the research into self-esteem, which showed that people who were more confident tended to be more successful in life. But then Roy realized that the researchers had it backwards, that self-esteem does not cause success, rather success causes self-esteem. Winning the Nobel Prize will make you feel good about yourself, but feeling good about yourself will not get you to Stockholm. If it did, Donald Trump would be there every year. Now, when Roy looked at dozens of personality traits, he discovered that only one of them predicted how well a student would do in college. It was not self-esteem, it was self-control. Self-control predicted college grades better even than IQ or SAT scores. And it predicted lots more, as researchers found as they studied people throughout their lives. I'll give you a quick summary of two decades of research. However you define success, you know, happy family, successful career, good grades in school, good friends, however you define it, it correlates with two things: intelligence and self-control. Now, so far, researchers haven't figured out how to increase intelligence, but they have figured out how to improve self-control. They've rediscovered the concept of willpower. Now, scientists used to dismiss willpower as this quaint Victorian metaphor, you know, invented by these sort of uptight Victorians who had this primitive idea that there was some kind of steam engine inside your body that powering your ability to resist temptations. Now, it seemed quite fanciful, this idea, until Roy Baumeister, my collaborator, decided to test it one day in his lab. And he invited students, he asked them to skip lunch, and he told them to come to the lab later in the afternoon. He told them that it was an experiment in how they tasted food, which, as usual, was a lie. Social psychologists never tell the guinea pigs what the experiment's really about. Now, when the students got there, they were really hungry, and they would be greeted by this beautiful aroma of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. And there would be a bowl of them sitting right on the table. And right on the table next to it was a bowl containing raw radishes. Now, the lucky students were told they could have some cookies. The unlucky students were told they had been assigned to the radish condition. No cookies for you, but have as many radishes as you'd like. Now, to maximize the temptation, you know, each student was left alone in that room, but the scientists were watching through a closed window. And they could see that these poor kids were, you know, that they agonized. You know, they would go over and look at the cookies. They would sometimes pick one up and smell it. But they all managed at least to resist the temptation to eat it. Then afterwards, all the students were given puzzles to do. And the students thought that this was a test of their cleverness. But in fact, the puzzles were unsolvable. The real test was how long they would persevere. Now, the ones who'd been allowed to eat the chocolate chip cookies, they typically worked away for 20 minutes and then they finally gave up. But the ones in the radish condition gave up after just 8 minutes. Now, that's less than half the time, which is a huge difference by experimental standards. You know, they had successfully managed to resist the temptation of the cookies, but that effort left them with less energy to solve the puzzles. So the old Victorian metaphor was actually right. Willpower really is a form of energy, and it can be depleted. Now, this sort of depletion happens to all of us all day long. By tracking people from morning through night, researchers have calculated that we typically spend between 3 and 4 hours a day resisting temptations. You know, the temptation to eat, the temptation to goof off, temptation to fall asleep during an after-dinner speech. Remember George Washington? And that's not the only way that you deplete your willpower. After this cookie experiment, a young colleague in Roy's lab came in one day. After the previous night, she and her fiancé had been compiling their bridal registry, you know, which towels, which silver, which place settings. And it left her feeling really exhausted, and it gave the researchers an idea. So they did some experiments in the lab, and they went to a shopping mall. And they found that the more decisions a shopper made, the less energy they had, the less willpower they had to work on puzzles and do other mental tasks. So making decisions depleted the same source of mental energy as resisting temptation. We call this decision fatigue. And once it sets in, your brain looks for shortcut in two very different ways. You know, one way is just to not think through the consequences of the decision. You just act impulsively, you know, sure, go ahead, tweet that photo in your underwear, what could go wrong? And the other shortcut is the ultimate energy saver. You just do nothing. You duck the decision. Now, that can be, you know, that solves the problem at the moment, but it can be really costly in the long run. Now, decision fatigue is worse now than ever because there are so many decisions we all face all day long. We're not medieval serfs who are doing one simple job all day long, the same thing our parents did. And just all day long, you've got the decision, which email do I open, which text do I reply to, which phone call do I return, which website do I visit. You can't deal with, you know, all these decisions at once. So here's another bit of science to help keep you focused on this. It's based on something called the Zagarnik effect, which is named after a psychology student at the University of Berlin named Bluma Zagarnik. One day, she and some fellow psychologists, it was a large group of them, went to a restaurant. And the waiter came, he took their order, it was a big group, he took all their orders without writing anything down, and then he delivered everything perfectly. And they were really impressed with this. So after lunch, they left the restaurant, somebody had forgotten something, and went back to the restaurant to retrieve it, and saw the waiter, and kind of smiled at him, hoping this guy's excellent memory would help them. And the waiter just looked back at him blankly, had no idea who the guy was. And he then explained that as soon as he delivered an order, it just vanished from his memory. Well, this got the psychologist thinking, does the brain make a big distinction between finished and unfinished tasks? And they went back to the lab and they found that, in fact, this is true, that there's a special place in memory for unfinished tasks. And while it's there, the brain will keep nagging you to finish that task until it's completed. I mean, that's why when you turn off the radio in the middle of a song, that song can just keep playing in your head all day because the task is unfinished and your brain is nagging you at that. You know, that's why when there's unfinished work sitting on your desk, that saps your mental energy. And it's going to keep sapping your mental energy until you either finish the task or until you use another strategy that was demonstrated in Roy Baumeister's lab. They took some students who had an upcoming exam that they were worried about. And they had them read some pages of a novel that had nothing to do with that exam. And just as predicted, they kept getting distracted by thoughts of the exam, and they didn't do that well on a comprehension test. Then another group of students came in. They also had this exam. But before they read the novel, they were instructed to make a plan for dealing with the exam, like, you know, set time on the calendar to go study in the library Sunday afternoon. Once they made that plan, they were able to concentrate much better on the novel and score higher on the test afterwards. They still had the exam ahead, but just making that plan had cleared their minds. Now I'm going to try and clear your minds by giving you some specific strategies for applying the science of willpower. And I'm going to try to outdo Brother Ty by giving you not 7.5, but 8 strategies. Starting with strategy number 1, watch for signs that your willpower is low. Know your limits. You know, there's no single telltale symptom of when your willpower is low. It's not like getting winded or hitting the wall during a marathon. What actually happens is that you start to experience everything more strongly because you can't regulate your emotions as well anymore. So donuts look especially tempting. Your roommate might seem especially irritating. Remember that every little act of self-control and every little decision will sap your willpower. So pick your battles. You know, don't make more than one New Year's resolution. You know, don't schedule back-to-back classes all day or back-to-back meetings. In fact, you might do what the editors of the New York Times magazine did after I turned in the draft of my article on decision fatigue. They read it and they promptly resolved no more meetings after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They just realized, they recognized their limits. You can think of willpower as a muscle that gets fatigued with use. That's the bad news about it. But the good news is that you can also gradually strengthen that muscle over time. You can build up its stamina. And that is strategy number 2, which is build your willpower. In one experiment, some students were sent home with instructions for the next couple weeks to sit up straight. Basically, whenever they found themselves slouching, they should try to sit up straight or stand up straight. Then they went back to the lab and they had to perform a bunch of tasks. And the researchers were a bit surprised that this worked. This was kind of supposed to be a control group. But what actually happened was they were able to do all these mental tasks and all these other tasks much better. And these tasks did not involve posture at all. And then other studies showed that when students worked on one part of self-control, like controlling their spending, eventually, over time, they got better at other forms of self-control when it came to studying and when it came to their diet. So the research has shown that really any repeated exercise in self-control will gradually build up your willpower. It's really what the Victorians, with lots of their little character-building exercises, they were onto something. That, they realized that these little acts of self-control can build up your willpower over time. Now, there's also a much simpler and quicker way to build your willpower, which is strategy number 3, eat. I love giving this advice at dinner. You're already on the path to virtue here. Experiments have shown that simply drinking a glass of lemonade will strengthen and will give you a temporary boost in willpower. But the lemonade has to contain sugar. It doesn't work if it contains Splenda, because you need the sugar because sugar provides glucose, which is the fuel for willpower. Now, experimenters use sugar because it gives a very quick effect in the lab, but it's a really quick up and down. And I don't recommend you try that at home, especially if you're in New York and you want to get a big soda. It's better to eat foods that release glucose slowly, because all foods release it, and eat something healthier that does it throughout the day. But whatever your diet, don't make any big decisions on an empty stomach. And if you do end up in a position where you have an expense account, I think you should remember one of the most important scientific lessons of the past half century, which is that there is now finally a scientific justification for the expense account lunch. So, strategy number 4 is to avoid the planning fallacy. Just about all of us routinely underestimate how long a job will take. This planning fallacy, as it's called, means that a project typically takes twice as long as predicted, and often more. That's why many people, their to-do list for a week will have more stuff than they could possibly do in a month. And you're better off trying to, keep it to 1, 2, or 3 goals for a week and just stick to that and get one goal done first before you do it. Now, even when you do set realistic goals, you still have to figure out all the little steps to get to each goal. And that is strategy number 5, which is to make a to-do list that's actually doable. Because you want to avoid the Zagarnik effect. You don't want things nagging at you. And you won't avoid that if you write things down on your list that you don't really know how to do. Like, if you put a vague thing like find new apartment, that's going to keep nagging at you because you haven't really figured out how to do that. You need to write something very specific, like check Craigslist for listings or call Jennifer to ask her for advice. You need to make a specific plan, something you know precisely how to do, something that David Allen calls the next action. David Allen is the author of a book, Getting Things Done, which is the one modern self-help book that I recommend besides my own. And what he found, he was a corporate trainer, and he found that corporate executives were just getting swamped because they would have these grand goals, but they were just absolutely overwhelmed by all the little stuff on their desk, all the emails in their inbox, all the thing, all the reports they had to use. So he figured out this system for basically eliminating the Zagarnik, for making plans to deal with everything that crosses your desk, and for keeping your inbox empty. Now, once you've cleared your mind from that, you can focus on the next strategy, which is 6. Keep track. The way Thomas Jefferson did. You don't maybe have to be quite as compulsive as him, but monitoring your progress toward a goal is just as important as setting the goal. It's essential to any kind of self-control. If you want to cut spending, keep track of it. If you want to lose weight, get on a scale every day. That's one of the few proven ways for losing weight. Strategy number 7 is what I call the nothing alternative. Now, it was inspired by Raymond Chandler, the great novelist and screenwriter, He turned out masterpieces like The Big Sleep by going into an office every day and following two simple rules. A, you don't have to write. B, you can't do anything else. And his idea was you'd eventually get bored enough that you'd have to write. Now, the nothing alternative to me is a perfect strategy for the internet age. No matter what you're trying to do, try to set aside 90 minutes, ideally at the start of the day, to just work only on that project. No emails, no phone calls, no web surfing. And you can open the Stopwatch app on your phone and just until it hits 90, don't do anything else but that. This strategy works because it's what researchers call a bright line rule, which is it's a rule that's easy to follow because it's very clear when you've crossed it and when you haven't. And you can create lots of other bright line rules too, like, you know, no Facebook, no Twitter before noon. Now, it does take self-control and willpower to start following those rules. But if you drop just a few and you follow them, eventually they become habits and something you start doing without conscious effort. And once something becomes a habit, you're benefiting from the final and the most important strategy of all. Number 8, conserve your willpower. This strategy comes out of a study that didn't turn out the way it was supposed to. The researchers wanted to understand why some people had more self-discipline in their lives than others. And so they tracked these people all day long and compared them with other people. And they expected to see these really disciplined people using their strong willpower all day long to resist temptations. But when they added up all the data, they saw that these people actually used willpower less often than average. And they didn't know what to make of this until they realized what these people's secret was. They structured their lives to minimize temptations. You know, they stayed away from all-you-can-eat buffets. They didn't keep bowls of candy on their desks or gallons of ice cream in the freezer. If they wanted to focus on a project, they turned off email notifications. You know, they conserved their willpower so that it was available for emergencies and for important decisions. And these findings, when I wrote about them, they inspired a couple of very different chief executives to make changes in their life, Mark Zuckerberg and Barack Obama. Each of them, after hearing about decision fatigue and what it does to your willpower, they both started wearing the same thing every morning so as not to make decisions. One of them wore, I think it was a gray T-shirt and a black hoodie. The other one wore a dark business suit. I'm not sure which was which, but now President Obama also started, he stopped making any decisions about what to eat. He left that to the White House chef, or maybe Michelle. But he was outsourcing decisions. He was outsourcing self-control. And you can do the same thing even if you don't have a staff like his. I mean, instead of deciding every morning whether or not to exercise, you can make an appointment to work out with a friend, so it's really not a choice. You don't have to expend any energy doing that. You can outsource self-control to Facebook groups or to apps that keep track of what you do. You can install something that turns your computer off from the web for a few hours a day. I know that, you know, these strategies, they may sound a bit Victorian on this idea of building character. They may sound a little tedious. But I can tell you that they really do make life easier in the long run. All my life, I had a terrible problem with procrastination. I never turned in a college paper or a New York Times column until the absolute deadline, if then. But when Rory and I wrote our book on willpower, I decided to try all 8 of these strategies. You know, I watched for signs my willpower was low, and I made allowances for it. I tried slowly strengthening that willpower muscle. I didn't try dealing with big problems on an empty stomach. I set just a few goals, and I kept track of my progress toward them. I blocked out specific time every day to do nothing but write. And I conserved willpower by eliminating as many decisions and temptations as I could. Now, the result, we finished the book 2 months ahead of time. Our editor, I think, is still not recovered from the shock of a manuscript arriving early. I haven't either, actually. But now, I've been stressing here tonight a lot of the personal benefits of willpower, and they're quite real. But ultimately, self-control is about much more than self-help. Of all the findings in Roy Baumeister's lab, the most heartening to me is this, that people with strong willpower use it to help other people. They donate more to charity. They do more volunteer work. They use their strength, their inner discipline, to help other people. They take care of themselves and of their neighbors without the need for external control. You know, they don't depend on a nanny state to do the right thing. And that's why individual self-control is the ultimate alternative to state control. And if there's one thing I'm pretty sure about this audience, I think you know which alternative is better.
John Tierney is co-author of Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. Learn more about Cato University at our website, cato.org.